Members, I'm calling the meeting to order unofficially because we do not yet have a quorum. But Representative Dabney, you're here. Mm-hmm. Are your testifiers here?
Yes, they are.
Well, will you, would you be willing to at least begin the process?
Certainly, Madam Chair.
So, members, we cannot move 1024 yet because we're not official. But Representative Dabney was so kind as to take the chief authorship of this so that I could be in the chair here. And I'm hoping that one of the testifiers, or you, Representative Dabney, will make mention to the report that was delivered to the legislature from that stakeholder group, and maybe one of your testifiers will do that. But no, I'm seeing shaking of heads.
Yeah, you're nodding to the right, shaking to the
Ms.
left.
Ms. Abderholden will. Yes, very good. So, members, we are on 1024, and I can't move it yet because we do not have a quorum yet. But welcome to the committee. We have a quorum. Oh, we're officially called to order. And with that, let's get the minutes out of the way. Representative Nornes, will you be so kind as to move approval of the minutes?
Madam Chair, I move the minutes of March the 3rd.
Representative Nornes moves the March 3rd minutes. Is there any discussion?
What's the number?
Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Welcome, Representative Dabney, to the testifying table. Will you move your bill, and you will be moving it to finance. Where is he moving it? To finance, right? Yes.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1024 to be before the committee and be referred to the Committee on Education Finance.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And you have an amendment, the A1 amendment?
I do, Madam Chair.
Will you move that, please?
I'd like to move the A1. This is an author's amendment to get the bill in the form that I would
Representative
prefer.
Dabney moves the H1024A1 amendment. Will you please explain your amendment?
Madam Chair, this relates to, and this kind of can serve also as the introduction to the bill. Bipartisanly, we've worked a number of years now to reduce and eliminate the use of seclusion and restraint in schools in Minnesota. With a deadline coming up for some of the prohibitions, if on the A1 amendment, if members look on page 2, lines 24 and 25, it refers to the stakeholders' ability to refer to, recommend to the commissioner specific and measurable implementation goals to continue to move in the positive direction we have been successfully as a state.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. So he's made it a permissive. Members, if you note on the amendment, on page 2 of the amendment, as Representative Dabney said, line
24 and 25, Madam.
Yes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the adoption of this amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Please explain your bill, Representative Dabney.
Certainly. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And we have been working for a number of years now to reduce and eliminate the use of seclusion and restraint in Minnesota schools. This work has been led by a stakeholders group of those concerned for the well-being of special education students who have particularly behavioral or autistic spectrum disorders and have behavioral challenges in school. This bill, the HF 1024, asks for $750,000 in fiscal year 2016 be appropriated to the commissioner to provide training and technical assistance to those school districts that need it to help them work with their professional development of their staff to be able to continue towards the path of reduction and elimination of these procedures. With me today, I'll start, I believe, with Ms. Abderholden from NAMI, Minnesota.
Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI, Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness.
The 2009 legislature passed legislation limiting how schools could use seclusion restraints on special ed students, and they could only be used in an emergency by trained staff, and schools were required to keep documentation, review data, and inform parents. And the law went into effect in August of 2011, so we gave schools basically 2 years to get ready for this. Since that time, we've made several revisions to the law, and we now have an annual report that's submitted to the legislature, which you should all have. And I want to point out that, we set up this system to figure out how we could reduce the use, and we have. The use of prone restraints was reduced by 41% in 3 years, and the number of children it was used on dropped by 20%, down to 159 children. And just 5 students accounted for nearly 30% of the use of prone restraints. 59% of these children received a free or reduced lunch. 80% were classified under the autism spectrum disorder or emotional and or behavioral disorder special ed categories. The use of other types of restraints and the use of seclusion dropped significantly as well. And while we've made great progress, and I really am, I just want to say really proud of the work that the school districts have done. We have worked very closely with them on this. This is not hit people over the head. This is really engage them and try to figure out together how to do this. Last year, you appropriated $250,000 to help schools reduce the use of them. And MDE actually developed a grant process. They targeted 7 districts, including 3 intermediate districts with students who experienced the highest usage of restrictive procedures and prone restraints. 6 grants totaling $150,000 were approved, and the work will be completed this June. MDE also asked, developed an RFP for 3 online training modules to address the 3 subsets of students with disabilities who experience the highest rate of prone restraints. And this included students with a combination of severe mental illnesses and developmental disabilities, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, students with severe aggressive self-injurious behaviors, and students with severe intellectual impairments and aggressive or self-injurious behaviors. So what we really are looking to do now is we know we have this small subset of kids that are really difficult to serve. And what we want to use this money for is, one, if a district sometime during the year, perhaps the student transfers, they get a child where they're using a high use of seclusion restraints, they don't know what to do, we need to bring in an expert, not necessarily someone from MDE, but someone maybe somewhere else in the state who can help the district understand those child's needs, figure out what to do so that they don't have to use those types of procedures. And then the other part of it would really have funding for districts that are looking to reduce it. They may be able to learn a lot from an intermediate district that has worked with a lot of these children, and so kind of sharing that knowledge. We are absolutely headed in the right direction, and those of you who have been here for a while know how contentious this issue was before. You know, we're here together as advocates and districts working together to address this issue, and I think that these funds will really go a long way. And thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Abter Holden. When I read through the report and was looking at the recommendations from the stakeholder group, I noticed that parents were missing. So could you answer for us to what extent parents and the school districts are working closely, and maybe the other testifier will address this too, so that, you know, what I hear is that there might be a structure in the school and that's not at home, or vice versa. You know, I think of iPads. Parents at home, for example, want an iPad restricted at a certain hour so the child settles down before going to bed. But, you know, the school has not restricted that use to get ready for that. So to what extent, Ms. Abter Holden, were parents involved in the stakeholder group to give recommendations?
Madam Chair, I would say that many of the advocates are also parents, and so we're bringing that expertise to, or some of the advocates, you know, hear a lot from parents, and so hear the stories, you know, have gone to IEP meetings and understand that piece. I also believe that by having school-linked mental health services, that we've actually, in some instances with children who have serious mental illnesses, we've been able to bridge that gap better, because it really is more of a team approach. People are sharing information and kind of really talking about how to help that child.
Thank you. And to our other testifier, please introduce yourself and say your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Connie Hayes. I'm superintendent at Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. I participated, or have been participating, for a number of years on the stakeholder group as the superintendent representative, and also as a representative of the intermediates who are serving many of these complex students. And I certainly want to offer my support to the appropriations before you today and hope that we're able to deliver those resources to school districts. Both of these recommendations, as Ms. Abderholden has reported, came out of our stakeholder discussion. My probably number one purpose for spending the time that I have on this stakeholder group was to advocate for very specifically the students that we're talking about in this bill. At 916, we serve anywhere between about 400 to 450 level four students on a day-to-day basis in our programs. And amongst those particular learners, again, on any given day, about 5% of those students have extraordinarily complex needs. One of the things I learned when I came to 916 is that there is, I use the term, there is no Mayo Clinic for these students. And really, we are the Mayo Clinic. But even with this 5%, we do struggle, and we feel we need some additional expertise to find the keys to unlock what their specific challenges are. And I have to say, all of us do believe the key does exist. We just simply have to find it, getting all the right experts around the table, along with the families, to do problem solving. The second piece of this bill, in terms of offering technical assistance to school districts, actually came out of a recommendation that we are in the process of trying to implement at our intermediate school district. And it came about as a result of one of our social workers who was telling me a story about helping to transition a young person back to their home district after they'd made significant progress at 916. And she said, wouldn't it be great if we could offer the local school districts some of our expertise to help prevent some of these young people from being referred to 916. And that was really the birth of the discussion in our district to try to develop a service to offer to our member districts to do exactly that. It's complicated, resources are limited, but we believe it will be better for kids and families. And I simply have come to the conclusion we will never be able to build enough programs to serve all of these students unless we start to figure out some ways to reduce the number of students coming into these level four programs. And I think this may be a first step to do so. I do have to speak for all districts in the state. They may not have the capacity to do this, but for those of us that do have an opportunity, we would much appreciate some resources to do so. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Superintendent Hayes, and thanks for your work, because I know what you have taken on is an extraordinary responsibility, and we thank you for serving our students and working with our teachers and others who you employ, I know, to help you. Representative Nornes has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do recognize the challenge that you have, and even the request for this amount of money doesn't seem like it's quite large enough when you look at the whole state. The question I have is the experts. Who are they, and where do they get their expertise from, and what's the pool out there? Are there enough of them, or?
Superintendent Hayes.
Well, we do have some workforce challenges that, as a state, we're trying to move forward on. But the experts are mental health practitioners. We do bring in psychiatrists on occasion. And the practitioners that are working with kids who have practiced strategies and found them to be effective, those are also some of the experts that we have to bring to the table. I don't know of a national expert that has the black bag they can open up and say this is the strategy. All of those resolutions or programs that we develop for individual students are exactly that. They're very individualized based on the complexity of that particular student. So whatever the needs that the student brings to the table, we try to match the experts that, you know, have some training and experience and expertise to assist us.
Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could, Representative Nornes, I can give you a recent example. We had a mom that we were talking with in southern Minnesota. She had moved to the state about 6 months ago. Her child is on the autism spectrum, also has bipolar disorder and anxiety. And the school was using a high number of seclusion restraints. And they asked her, in your old state, did this happen to your child? And she said, hardly ever. And so they said, well, could we call the school in the other state and talk to them? And they had an expert on staff who was an expert on autism spectrum disorders. They talked through it, and the use of seclusion restraints has significantly been reduced because of that. So sometimes if you can just bring in someone who, one, is either really familiar with that child, and we do have children who, you know, change districts all the time, but we do have a few experts in the state who really look at co-occurring disorders, and those kids tend to be the hardest to serve, and so we want to be able to bring their expertise in.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak in support of or with concerns to House File 1024 as amended? Mr. Lundell? No? That's okay. Are you coming down or aren't you? No.
No.
I just saw you moving up there and know this is your area, so thank you. With that, members, I will renew Representative Dabney's motion that House File 1024, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Education
and
Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you very much, Representative Dabney, and thank you, Superintendent Hayes and Ms. Abderholden. Representative Christensen. 1, 2, 3, 7. Welcome to the testifying table. Representative Christensen, if you would move 1237 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the in an omnibus bill.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1237 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Please explain your bill.
I'd like to start out with introducing my testifier here, Jonah Weinberg, and he'd like to talk a little bit about the bill and how it will affect students with special needs.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jonah Weinberg. I'm the Executive Director at the Autism Society of Minnesota. Our organization has been in Minnesota serving the autism community since 1971, and we think this is a very important bill because so many students with disabilities are assisted in the classroom by paraprofessionals, and at times these individuals don't understand the nature of the disability of the individual they're supposed to be helping, and we believe that it can actually work against the benefit of the student if that individual, if that paraprofessional, does not understand something about that disability and some of the challenges or nuances that can take place because of that neurodiversity that the individual has, whether it's autism, fetal alcohol syndrome, traumatic brain injury, or a variety of other disabilities which are commonly present in our classrooms.
Very good. Mr. Weinberg, do you know whether or not paraprofessionals, as they're getting their credentials or renewing their credentials, have had much opportunity to be exposed to the need for this? Are you aware of that at all?
To my knowledge, Madam Chair, there is no requirement that they be exposed to any of this. What we've found is that oftentimes paraprofessionals come in, they have the greatest of intention to be helpful to a student, but without an understanding that a child's about a child's challenges perhaps with sensory integration or emotional regulation, their efforts, guided by the best logic of somebody who is used to working with individuals who don't have these disabilities, could actually cause them to be detrimental in the student's progress. So, for example, if you have a student who perhaps is engaged in some repetitive motion thing, perhaps they move their arms, perhaps they have a fidget that they play with, and the paraprofessional doesn't understand the importance of that and tries to take it away from them or tries to get them to be calm, that actually can raise their anxiety, which case the paraprofessional may feel threatened, may feel confused by the actions, and we actually believe that this could help reduce turnover in the paraprofessional industry because they would not feel so challenged by the students that they're working with.
Thank you, Mr. Weinberg. And yes, paraprofessionals today have a huge responsibility. Representative Christensen, you have other testifiers as well, correct?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair, and I'd like to invite them up to the table now.
And we have a student with us this morning, which is very exciting.
It's too early.
Yes, we would agree, but, you know, this is the way the world operates. So. Welcome to our committee, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. My name is Alex Miller. I am so grateful for this opportunity to speak to all this morning. You will never guess this, but I have neurological damage from prenatal alcohol exposure. This is the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities for employment, transportation, public accommodation, communications, and governmental activities. We have come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. For example, all of us expect the same high-quality education as our peers, and we need paras that support us to understand our unique needs. This year, House File 1237 proposes legislation that will require paraprofessionals in our school systems to have specific training on the unique needs of the kids they support. No one should assume that what I'm going through. In my experience, the teachers and paras who understood me were more flexible and more willing to work side by side with the students with special needs. The paras who understood me understood my unique challenges, made me feel like I could do well, and motivated me to do better. The paras who didn't made me feel like I was the weak link and I wasn't trying or else I didn't care. It is frustrating because I want to explain to them what I am feeling, and they just treat me like I'm trying to get out of doing the work. The paras who understood me were more like another parent. They were there for me, and they pushed me to do the best I could. They wanted me to do well. There should be a bigger view of learning disabilities of all students. There is more than one type of animal in a jungle. You would not expect a fish to climb a tree, would you? Instead of just telling us what to do, the paras who care and understand our needs make learning more fun. All educators should have training on specific needs because it will help them teach students with all kinds of challenges, identified or not. Looks can be very deceiving. Some days I may look fine on the outside, but the inside may be a total mess. For me, it was hard for me to get assignments written in my planner, things put into my backpack that I needed, and to get those assignments completed and turned in. The paras that understood my situation were patient, gave me the support I needed, and they were there to help me. They understood that some days I was firing on all cylinders and things were working fine. They also understood that other days, nothing was connecting, and they stepped in to help me. They were like training wheels on a bike. If I leaned too far to one side, they were there to correct me and to teach me how to ride on my own someday. As a senior in high school, I can look back and easily identify the parents and teachers who understood my challenges and cared enough to help. Training on issues specific to fetal alcohol syndrome, spectrum disorders, or whatever disorders they are dealing with, will help our educators understand our needs. Understanding leads to compassion. Compassion leads to action and support. At some point, every educator will teach someone with an FASD, and every para will help a student with FASD. It doesn't take much training at all to make a big difference in how they work with us. For those of us living with a disability, a positive experience in school can lead to a positive experience in life. Our early experiences in school can help set the direction for our entire educational experience. Please support this legislation that will help give paraprofessionals the basic training that will make all the difference in our school experiences. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Alex. That was very well delivered and very well written.
Thank you.
And for coming so early, we really
Rooster
appreciate
it.
Yes, we all can relate to that.
Yeah.
But this is the way it operates around here. We have to schedule meetings, and some have to fall early. Welcome, Ms. Black, to the committee, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to be here this morning. My name is Laura Block. I'm a board member and volunteer at the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, and I'm also Alex's mom. You can imagine how proud I am of him. He's handsome and bright and charming and happy and engaging. He's a gifted athlete and a loyal friend. You could spend a lot of time with Alex and not have any idea that he has a significant disability. Alex started to receive help from paras in the classroom in third grade. Most, if not all, of the paras that have worked with us over the years truly cared about the kids that they worked with. They truly cared about Alex. Not all of them, however, understood the nature of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and the challenges, the unique challenges that Alex faced. For example, with FASD, it's common for the corpus callosum, which runs down the center of the brain, to be damaged. That's what connects left brain activity to right brain activity. And so what that means is that Alex may know the information, but not have the ability to access it and recall it on the day of a test, for example. When Alex was younger, we'd work on spelling words at home. We'd work and work and work. He'd have them down cold. He'd go off and play. A couple hours later, I'd call him back and say, let's just quick review these words. And it was like he'd never seen the list before. We were starting at square one. It was all gone. The odd thing was, 6 weeks later, I'd come across that list in a pile of papers and say, hey, Alex, how do you spell this? And he'd go right down the list and get them all correct. Even though he knew the words, that recall piece was really a challenge for him. Alex's initial diagnosis was inattentive ADD. That's how it looks in the classroom for him. A para who doesn't know what I just told you about FASD might think that Alex is simply distracted or just not paying attention. The tendency in that case would be to just take Alex to a quieter corner of the room and continue to press him to come up with answers. That can be very frustrating for Alex, and it can be very frustrating for the para. A common statement he hears is, I know that you know this. While that may be true, knowing it and accessing it and being able to recall it when it's needed are completely different things. A para who understands this unique challenge of FASD may choose instead to say, I know you've worked really hard on this. Let's just set it aside for now. We'll come back tomorrow and try again. If Alex were deaf, no one would expect him to follow verbal directions without some kind of accommodation. Alex's disability, however, is largely invisible. It's often misinterpreted as lazy or an attitude. And I assure you, this is not the case. Alex works harder than any other student I know. A para without training might actually escalate his challenges without realizing it. A woman recently came to our organization frustrated over this training issue. She is a para in northern Minnesota. She had just gotten a new student who had a physical disability, and the district had provided her specific training on that student's disability. She also herself has a child with FASD. When she requested that same training opportunity for the para that works with her child, she was told that if the para wanted training, she'd have to get that on her own time. The training that we're asking for here doesn't have to be cumbersome or expensive or excessively time-consuming. Many of the organizations that are already supporting this bill are providing low-cost and no-cost training already, and they're providing it both in person and online. As a volunteer, I was at Minnetonka Middle School 2 weeks ago providing a 45-minute training on FASD as a part of their teacher in-service program. MOFAS, the organization I'm with, coordinated this training at no cost to the school. Tonight, Alex and I are speaking to a group of early childhood special needs educators, again, at no cost to the districts involved. We choose to do this because we know that even a little bit of training makes such a big difference. I ask you to support this legislation for Alex and for all of the kids who depend on help from the paras to get through their school experience. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Black. And thanks for the volunteering that you're doing and providing this. So often, you know, we don't know where to look. And here we have these organizations, and you can provide that, so thank you. Representative Christensen, you have other testifiers as well. I'm not sure if Superintendent Hayes wanted to address this or any.
Madam Chair, these are my only testifiers.
Okay. So with that, maybe you should stay there, Ms. Block. I know there are some questions. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify in favor of or has concerns, please come forward. And Pages, maybe you can provide another chair. Thank you. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you, Chair Erickson, members of the committee. My name is David Aaron. I am a staff attorney at Education Minnesota. I have the privilege of working with a number of the special education paraprofessionals that work throughout our state. Education Minnesota wholeheartedly supports this bill, and we'd like to thank Representative Christensen for authoring it and the committee for considering it. We agree that special education paraprofessionals play an incredibly important role in the lives of our students with disabilities. Unfortunately, our members often tell us that they don't receive adequate training and don't have adequate knowledge about the disabilities of the students that they work with. In many cases, you'll be surprised to hear that paraprofessionals start working in the school year the very first day that students start. So that's a problem because they often sometimes haven't seen the student's IEP and sometimes don't even know what disability the students that they're working with have. That's a problem, and we think that this bill would change that. This bill requires training, but it also requires the time necessary for paraprofessionals to understand their students' disabilities before they begin working with them, and we think that that's crucial to providing the services that our students need. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aaron. Now we have some questions. Representative Yaruso. Representative Nornes, do you have another question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Last Saturday, I met with two parents in my district with actually the same situation as you're describing today. And so this is really, I guess, very familiar to me. My wife also spent 32 years as a para in special education, so I also understand, you know, what you're talking about. And I think it probably illustrates also the burdensome paperwork that the teachers are actually spending their time on, because the paras, as I understand it, are really to work under a teacher at their direction. And that's the way it was with my wife. She learned on the job at the direction of a teacher. And I think there's certain individuals, my wife be one of them, who has a knack of understanding what each individual situation was. She was very successful and has some students to prove it. But I think we have to also go back and look at how the teachers are burdened with things that do not help students and as part of this. But I wholeheartedly support the bill as well.
Thank you. Representative Christensen.
Madam Chair, Representative Nornes, we'll have a part two later today with my second bill.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to thank Representative Christensen for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a great bill. And I would definitely like to say to Alex, you just did an awesome job. And I just thank the paraprofessional who were there for you, who understood you, who was able to lead you to a place where you felt valued and they recognized what you had to bring to the world. And to your mom, great job. As I think about this bill, it is really clear to me that there is a huge need for more paraprofessionals in the school system. I know within my district, which is a highly district of communities of color, that so often the disability is invisible. And so often the children, the students are sent to the principal office, they are dismissed, they are suspended at really high numbers. And so it's really, really important that we have trained professionals that can work with kids to minimize the disruption or the lack of engagement in the classroom, to really see the value and the assets that students bring to the table and to work on that part. So, again, you guys, awesome job. Representative Christensen, thank you for this bill.
May I add just one thing?
Yes, please, Ms. Powell.
Thank you for what you said, and it's so important to realize that it's not just at the elementary level. It almost becomes more important at the junior high and high school level because the kids are moving so fast in and out of different classrooms, and it isn't the experience of one teacher knowing that child really well. There might be multiple paras involved
with that child's educational experience.
Thank you for that comment, Ms. Block. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to our testifiers for being here today. And Alex, good job. You've been very successful, and I'm sure you'll be very successful in the future. And thank you for sharing your story. I did have a couple of questions just to get a better background. Wondering, I don't know, maybe Mr. Aaron would be the one to answer this, what kind of training paraprofessionals are already receiving, and how this might change what additional training they would get. And then also, are special education teachers receiving the same training, or is it a different kind of training? Just
Mr. Aaron,
if you could answer that.
Well, you know, the training that paraprofessionals receive varies widely throughout the state, and depending on the particular district and the program that they're working in. Certain districts impose certain education and training requirements for paras, and there are very few state mandates on what training paraprofessionals are required to receive. So, but this is one mandate that we think should be universal. I mean, not all paraprofessionals work directly in a classroom with students, but the ones who do should know, you know, what students' disabilities are and have some basic information. Most districts, thankfully, do provide ongoing professional development to their paraprofessionals, but we'd like that to be universal.
Mr. Aaron, how many of our paraprofessionals have credentials, have gone through that process of becoming credentialed?
I would have to do some research on that and get back to you, but I'd be happy to provide that information. I know that certain paraprofessionals who work in Title I funded positions are required to meet highly qualified requirements by federal law, but that is not universal. But in terms of the credentials for paras across the board, I can look into that and provide you with that information.
Thank you. Representative Wills, you had another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the explanation. I didn't quite catch how it compares to special education teachers' training. If you could expound on that, that would be helpful.
Mr. Aaron.
Special education teachers are required to hold licenses, and with that license, are all the standards that are present in the Minnesota rules, the 8710 section of the Minnesota rules. Those rules require, if I'm a LD licensed teacher, I have specific training by virtue of having a license about working with students with learning disabilities. Minnesota requires training specific to students' disability classifications in order to hold a particular license. So they do have training, usually through undergraduate coursework and continuing education, about their students' specific disabilities.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I think that helps us to understand that special education teachers have a lot of training, and paras are doing a lot of the same work right alongside those teachers, and I think that helps show how important it is for the paras to have this kind of training and to make sure that they're just as prepared as the special education teachers to work with those students. So I appreciate that additional information.
Mr. Aaron.
And I would just add, I appreciate Representative Noren's comment, because I think that our special education teachers want to provide that training to the paras that they work with, but timing is a huge issue. A special education teacher's time, unfortunately, is consumed with paperwork when they're not working with students. So, I'm glad that this bill requires training. I would hope that it would also add some funding to pay special education teachers for that time that they spend working with paraprofessionals, if they are the ones who are going to be providing the training.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank Representative Christensen for bringing forth this bill and our testifiers for the great information. I just wanted to make a comment as a teacher. Typically, our paraeducators, at least in my own school district, their hours are different, and they kind of come when the kids come and leave when the kids leave. It makes it really hard for teachers such as myself to be able to communicate with them, because as soon as they're here, the kids are there. So I think this is a great bill and will definitely help those paras understand more how to work with the kids.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think to the testifier, the bill, as I read it, focuses on ensuring that the paraprofessional is knowledgeable about the disability that the child has.
Correct.
Makes all sense. I don't see a stipulation that they're also familiar with the individual IEP that the student has, because both are at play. I need to know the disability. I also need to know the accommodations that this student receives, which, of course, varies from student to student and disability to disability. Can you speak to the training on the IEP for the paraprofessional, please?
Mr. Aaron.
In my experience, districts differ widely on their policy in terms of making a student's IEP accessible to paraprofessionals. IEPs are private educational data, paraprofessionals have been determined to have a legitimate educational interest in that data. Some districts, out of a concern for data privacy, say that paraprofessionals aren't entitled to see the full IEP. That's a debatable proposition, but I personally believe that there's no reason that if paras are provided training about confidentiality and the importance of that they shouldn't have access to the entire IEP of a student that they work with. But again, as Representative Bennett pointed out, the issue is time. Special education teachers don't have time to sit down with every paraprofessional and go over that IEP under current staffing models. So this bill doesn't speak specifically to IEPs, but even if it requires that information to be summarized for paraprofessionals, that would be a huge step in the right direction. I think the most important things that paraprofessionals need to know is, what is this student's classification? What are the accommodations? And if there's any kind of functional behavioral assessment or behavioral intervention plan, is that in place? And what does the paraprofessional need to do to follow it?
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
That strikes me as an area of concern. I recognize when we walk into special ed, we're walking into a minefield. But I assume that these people are adults, that they're professional, that they're employees, so there's disciplinary strategies available if they violate students' privacy and the like, and that something like an IEP they need access to on a need-to-know basis, and they need to know what's in that IEP so that they are implementing it. The mother here particularly focused on the middle and high school level. As the student is moving from class to class, what we want is consistency across the student's day. And if the paraprofessional is not allowed access to the IEP, which speaks to how do you deal with Johnny and how do you support Johnny, that strikes me as problematic. Knowing in the abstract the disability is great and important. Knowing how it applies to Johnny is really, when my daughter had an IEP, that's what I wanted. Perhaps an amendment, Representative Christensen, as you move along, I let you consider that. Thank you, Madam.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Dabney, for your comments. And we'll definitely, looking at certainly paraprofessionals, knowing how it affects an individual student is important, and I think that's something we should look at going forward.
And thank you, Representative Dabney. I think we will do a little research project on that. I had a question for you, Representative Christensen, about there's no effective date. Is that because the language says in Clause A that at the beginning of each school year, each school district shall have in effect, and then we continue through each of the enumerated items? Can you address that?
I defer to Ms.
Larson. Ms. Larson, is there a need for an effective date, or is it implied because of how the statute reads.
Madam Chair, members, this is not a finance bill, so there is not a default effective date specifically. My advice would be to state the intent of the author. There's every advantage to doing it and few advantages not to doing it. So, for example, if your intent is immediately, if your intent is the 15-16 school year, it would be a simple matter to amend the section to state the effective date for the law changes.
So, Representative Christensen, I would suggest, because I'm laying this over for possible inclusion, and it's likely to be included, that we will work on that and also on Representative Dabney's concern. So you can look forward to perhaps having an amendment when the omnibus bill appears in this committee.
Great.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Christensen and to the testifiers, I really appreciate your helping us understand the real impacts of this. I have a couple of concerns because we're going to be policy, but it's also, I mean, there's going to be an impact on finances to somebody because there is additional cost in time, if not actual paying for training. So I'm a little confused as to why there's not a fiscal note on this. If it is strictly local impact, it will take me back to my original thought when we were talking about all of this, is that we need to fund education. It's an investment that we know will pay dividends. We know that if we don't pay for these kinds of services, for the training, for people to be well prepared, that there is an additional cost down the road in terms of lives, successful lives, satisfying lives, family impact, and society's impact. So I struggle as an educator, as someone who's worked on these kinds of things for years, that we know what needs to be done and we know how to do it, but we don't fund it appropriately. And so I'm just confused as to why we're not saying anything about funding this.
Thank you, Representative Ward. When I lay this over, we'll check with the Finance Committee to find out if we need to bring this bill back up and re-refer it. So thank you for bringing that up. Closing comments, Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this bill is important not only for students like Alex, but also for the paraprofessionals themselves. I don't think it's fair to the students, and it's not really fair to the paraprofessionals if we're not adequately preparing them for the job that they have. So it's a good bill, and I'd appreciate your support.
With that, members, I'll renew Representative Christensen's motion that House File 1237 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Mullery. Welcome to our committee, Representative Mullery. Representative Moran, would you be willing to move House File 1094?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 1094.
And this will be laid over for possible inclusion as well.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Representative Mullery. Representative Moran has moved House File 1094 to be before us and to be laid over for possible inclusion. Nice to have you in our committee
Thank you, Madam.
Bill. And please introduce yourself and explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe Mullery, and as many of you know, I've been really working on early brain development for many years, and in going over, I had Tim Strom in my office and going over some funding, and we noticed that apparently by mistake the statute on home visitors hasn't been brought up to date in the ECFB area, which is where you'd think that most of it would have been first brought up to date to include brain development, because naturally education includes brain development. But the home visitors in DHS have already changed over to stressing brain development, but for some reason it never got into the statute here. So this morning we have Megan Gunner, who is head of the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota and is internationally known in this area. We also have Monica Potter, who runs the highly acclaimed ECFE program in the Robbinsdale area schools. And then we have Hector Garcia from the Chicano Latino Affairs Council to talk about how important this is for closing the achievement gap. So all the ECFE programs I know are all already including this, so we think it should be in statute. And the first would be Megan Gunner.
Thank you very much, Representative Mullery. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Yes, I'm Professor Megan Gunner. I'm the Director of the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota, the Associate Director for the Center for Neurobehavioral Development, also at the university. And for the 30, unfortunately, plus, I guess, years of my career, I have spent studying the effects of stress early in life on brain and behavioral development and the effects of early adversity on how our bodies and our brains develop. I'm here as a scientist and not an advocate, simply to talk to you all about what we are learning increasingly about the importance of the early years, conception to age 5, for the development of the human brain. We know now conclusively that the genes that we are born with, help to signal the time when different parts of the brain go into their activity to get organized. But the way that our brain is designed is that we use genetic information and the experiences, what we're thinking about. Our brain essentially becomes what we think about, the information that we process. And so the amount and the quality of information that children have available to them early in life is critically important during a period when the brain is developing very rapidly. Some of you may have, if you've been going to Joe's, Representative Mullery's events, seen the graphs on the impact of how many words a child is exposed to early in life and how that influences the development of vocabulary from early on to age 3, which is when the graphs end. What we know is early, there's no difference by social class or by the amount of words children are exposed to. By 3, we see the achievement gap absolutely present in their language. There is now a recent study by our friends over at Wisconsin looking at the development of the actual size of the brain, looking at the gray matter, those little gray cells that Hercule Poirot likes to talk about. At 5 months, there's no difference as a function of poverty to wealth in the size of the brain. By age 3, it maps exactly or very similar to what you saw in language development. And the actual physical size of the brain is different by 3 years of age. Now, this does not mean it's over. Brain development, your brains are still developing. Your brains are still plastic, at least if you're trying to learn new things.
Thank goodness.
But what it means is that by the time children are coming to some of the earliest things that we're doing, they're already behind. They lack the language and concepts that they're going to need to get. They actually lack the physical size of the brain. It will grow. It will be stimulated. Now, many of you know that early in interventions, big rewards. Art Rolnick has been talking to us a lot in the state about that. But you also know that when it's measured by IQ, we see these huge gains. And then by about third or fourth grade, it looks like there's no real difference, called fade out. IQ, and what I'm here to tell you about, is what we call crystallized intelligence. It's what you know. And that's important in developing your brain. But it seems that those earliest years are also critically important for setting up the programs, the neural pathways, for how you will use what you know. And for those of you who have looked into this, the amazing thing about these early programs is even though IQ fades out, you get a coming together. These kids who have had these better early experiences, where brain development has been fostered early, finish high school, hold down jobs, pay more taxes, don't get fired because they fail to show up for work, and don't end up in the criminal justice system as much, which costs us probably the most of our budgets. We are now beginning to understand that they also stay physically healthier throughout their lives and are less likely to develop as early some of those disorders of aging that many of us are now suffering with, which is why we take our pills for high cholesterol and all the rest of that, and diabetes, hopefully not for those of you. So my point is, early matters. Starting at age 4 is playing catch-up, which is not to say we shouldn't do the 4, 5, 6, all of that is important. But it is really important to help families and communities to support the development of children's brains from conception. You just heard about fetal alcohol syndrome. Let's avoid that by getting there early, through those early years until we get them to the school system where hopefully we're going to do well by them.
That's Thank you, Dr. Gunner. Very well said. And next, would you say your name for the record if you'd like to testify?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dr. Monica Potter, and I'm the Program Director for Robbinsdale Area Schools Early Childhood Programs. I'm also the Chair of MNAFI, which is the Minnesota Association for Family and Early Education. And I'm here in support of this bill due to the fact that currently these are things that we do in ECFE, and it needs to be in statute. You hear ECFE a lot, and you hear about the classes that we have. But a huge component in ECFE is also the home visits. And in my district, Robbinsdale Area Schools, about 50% of the families qualify for free and reduced lunch. So we'll do home visits. A licensed parent educator will go out and do a home visit with the families, whether it's in their home or at the school or at a library. They'll help families connect to community resources, and then they'll talk about brain development, such as if it's a home visit with a new infant, they'll talk about responding to the infant's cues, talking to the infant, singing to the infant, reading to the infant. So always when we go out for a home visit, it includes talking about early brain development and the importance. And we'll do one home visit or several home visits to try and connect them to us. So thank you for allowing me to join you today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Potter, and thank you for your work. Welcome, Mr. Garcia. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Hector Garcia, the Executive Director of the Latino Affairs Council, and I'm here to strongly support Bill 1094. For the following reasons. In thinking about the Minnesota paradox, I've often felt that perhaps we should look at the things that we're not doing rather than at the things that we've been doing for 40 years. And I think this is one of them. As Dr. Gunnar said, starting by age 4 might be a little bit too late, and we'll just be playing catch-up. I also find it very important because of the link between health and education, which is pioneering work that is being done at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital, Rochester Children's Hospital, and elsewhere. And I think it's very much on target, particularly with Latino students, Latino children. As you might know, Latino students suffer from the worst achievement gap and lowest graduation rates in the country in Minnesota. And there's a peculiar correlation with children from Latino families that have the lowest rates of kindergarten readiness in Minnesota as well. So there's probably a strong connection right there. I think that the earliest we can address the cultural challenges faced by Latino families, about 40% of our population are new immigrants who don't know a great deal about society, political system, educational system, and are dealing with very powerful challenges. Some of them work 2-3 jobs, and it's very hard for them to address the needs of their children. So whatever support you can provide this bill, I think it'll be a great investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia. Representative Whalen, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this bill, and to the testifiers for your comments. I just wanted to clarify a little bit about the line 1.14 in the bill where it says reaching those as early an age as possible. And then I heard the phrase conception to age 5 a couple times. Not that I'm opposed to that. I'm just wondering what possible interventions or how we would reach those children that are still in the womb. And then I might have a follow-up as well.
Ms. Potter, I think you could answer that one because you're in the program.
Yes. What we do in early childhood family education, the home visits start prenatally. So in the community, we work with medical facilities, child care centers. We receive lists from Hennepin County of all the births where we send out to all the children that are born free home visits, come to a free baby shower. We're in the community. I just hired this actually 2 months ago. A community needs specialist who is just finding communities, apartment buildings where we can just go and talk with families. So we do visits starting prenatally. And we also do hospital visits.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That sounds wonderful. I am wondering kind of just if you could expand a little bit more. I know you had mentioned, or somebody mentioned, that people will read or sing to their infants, and I know a lot of people actually do that even when they're still in the womb and provide that sort of care. So the visits and what you described sounds like helping the family and the mother, but do you do those things to help the infant in the womb as well? And then again, I'll probably have a follow-up.
Ms. Potter.
with pregnant mothers, it's more about explaining to them about their care and their health, because that impacts brain development in the womb. So, you know, there are different, and it depends, each home visit is a little bit different in what the needs of the families are. About 40% of our participants are fathers, and we also do a lot of work with teen parents. I have a parent educator that visits all three of our high schools on a weekly basis and does home visits with teen parents. And it's the boys as much as the mothers.
Representative Boylan?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mullery.
Dr. Gunner asked if she could also.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, Dr. Gunner.
Yes, from a scientific standpoint, the younger you get, the more we're talking two generations, at least two generations, when we're creating environments that will develop children to their maximum. So there's nothing like a healthy and happy mother carrying a baby to produce a healthy and happy baby whose brain is in good shape. So trying to separate at the younger you go, probably not from a scientific standpoint, all that necessary.
Representative Mullery, you wanted to say something?
No, Madam Chair. Okay. I just wanted to have...
Representative Whalen. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that explanation. Again, I think this sounds like a great thing to support those moms and infants at that early stage of development. I would just like a quick comment to point out that if as a state we're going to be supporting this, there is a little bit of, in my mind, inconsistency with some of our other laws regarding women's right to choose and whatnot. So to me, I do see inconsistency as a state if we're going to be supporting this versus some of our other pro-life laws. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a brief question. Is it Gunner?
Yes, Gunner.
Thank you. My apologies. Can you just speak, if you're familiar with research on the impact of the experience of homelessness on small children and brain development and the like, just brief, please.
Yes. Dr. Gunner. Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to close the achievement gap in the state, we have to close the problem of, we have to solve the problem of homeless young children. Homelessness is extremely stressful to families. I don't know about any of you, but none of us are perfect parents when we're under a lot of stress, and those families are under a terrible amount of stress. From what we know in terms of brain development, we know it by assaying the behaviors that these children, the cognitive and social behaviors of these children. We know that they are way behind, some of them as much as a year behind, on their ages and stages, on their capacity to engage in those executive functions, et cetera. The University of Minnesota and the Institute is doing tremendous work here, working with people serving people and working on interventions for children who are homeless and showing that we can do some good and getting them back on track. But those kids really do need our help. I, Dr. Chair, how that fits with this bill, but I'm here as a scientist, so you asked the question.
That's why I asked. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You know, members, we have some more bills on the agenda, so unless your question is pressing, we should move on. Representative Moran, is this a pressing question? I don't want to judge your question, but we have several in the audience, I know, who can only be here for a few minutes.
Okay, well, just really quick, Madam Chair, I just want to thank Representative Moran, Representative Mullery, for bringing this bill forward and just really bringing some awareness and engaging parents with some knowledge about the importance of brain development early, and that when we focus on that piece of it and with less trauma and less stress, that it really develops a more healthier brain, and that is really important to create better outcomes later in life.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Seltzer.
I'll make this really quick also. Thank you. Thank you for bringing this forward. I'm in total support. I just had a quick question, and I know we don't want to start a laundry list in the bill. That's a bad thing to do. But I'm just wondering if, you know, when these activities are presented to students, if they're to families and to parents, are they presented in a culturally competent way? In other words, when you have an understanding of the cultural background, and whoever wants to answer that, if you have a understanding of the cultural background of the family you are dealing with, is there a greater chance of success? And then, again, don't want a laundry list, but, you know, is that important enough to consider meriting some type of inclusion in here?
Mr. Garcia.
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, I would like to point out that culture is essential in order to be able to work with the families and with the children, and that is one of the aspects of this bill that really excited me, the focus that Representative Mullery placed on culture. So thank you for your question. It's very important.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Potter.
Thank you. I would just like to share with you that in the school district, Robbinsdale Area Schools, we work with the National Urban Alliance, Yvette Jackson, and we do a lot of training. Every teacher is required to attend a two-day workshop, Beyond Diversity, so there's a lot of training that goes along, and hiring staff members of all different cultures and diversity.
Thank you. Thank you very much, testifiers. And Representative Mullery, just a brief closing, please.
Madam Chair, just seems like something that we forgot to put in because it's so fitting for what we're trying to do, close the achievement gap and really achieve
every
success.
Thank you, Representative Mullery, and I know you've done such great work in this area. With that, members, I will renew Representative Moran's motion that House File 1094 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Representative Runbeck and House File 332, please bring your testifiers forward. Welcome to our committee, Representative Runbeck. I will move House File 332 to be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. And pages, to the extent you can, be sure we have chairs for everyone.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for hearing House File 332.
Representative Runbeck, will you introduce yourself too, please?
I'm State Representative Linda Runbeck, authoring the bill House File 332, and I've asked the page to hand out a very timely article that was in the Star Tribune yesterday about dyslexia, which is the subject of the bill, and it says, I think, very quickly what has been happening over the course of several years, which is that parent advocates have been paying close attention to the needs of their children in terms of literacy and have discovered that in Minnesota we don't pay proper attention to the issue and the learning disability labeled dyslexia. In fact, many of our teachers who are young and have been through the College of Education recently are not even familiar with this disability. And so it needs more awareness, and thankfully these parents have made the awareness happen. What the bill does is to really expand upon the local literacy plan that's been in effect now for several years. And it simply says that there are certain expectations that parents should have of the school district. So their literacy plan needs to be more specific and specify some things that have been listed here in terms of how they can access a program, how the screening might be done for dyslexia, and so on. In an attempt to really make parents a partnership with the schools and the learning that their children need. And then the second big piece of it is to define dyslexia. As somebody just said earlier, you can talk to teachers in any school, and they can talk about ADHD, and they can talk about autism at length. But a lot of them kind of don't have anything, and you know, don't have the background to understand dyslexia. But I would like to introduce Rachel Berger, who's the volunteer chair of the Decoding Dyslexia chapter in Minnesota, and she can introduce our guests.
Welcome, Ms. Berger. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Hi, Rachel Berger, Decoding Dyslexia. And I just want to introduce our guests that are here to speak today on behalf of our bill. I know that you have a lot to hear today, so without any further, I'd like to introduce Rachel Deepa.
Will you please say your name for the record and begin?
Yeah, my name is Rachel Deppa, and my son Isaiah was a lazy, uninterested, untrying ADD kindergartner, or so we thought. In order to understand Isaiah's story, you have to understand what kindergarten was like for him. Kindergarten is not coloring the lines, don't eat the paste, and let's learn our alphabet. They are coming out reading. When Isaiah was getting ready for kindergarten, we worked on his alphabet for 2 years. I was convinced that Isaiah had no desire to learn to read. He would get frustrated with me, start crying, and I would push him harder. Mm-hmm. My goal for entering kindergarten was that he be able to write his name. We accomplished that goal about halfway through kindergarten, and then our new goal began to be, let's write your name in under 8 minutes, upside down, backwards, just no erasing. The frustration I felt with Isaiah can't be described. I could show him a letter, show him a second letter, go back to that first letter, and it was like he had never seen it before. He learned his alphabet for the most part by the end of kindergarten. My kindergartner was barely skating by, and that was unacceptable to me. My son attends Delano Elementary School, an amazing public school, but we chose the school because of its gifted and talented program, not a special education program. My older son was reading going into kindergarten and reading chapter books coming out. I expected Isaiah would follow suit, so I pushed Isaiah. I got frustrated with him, and I pushed a little harder. That was until his first grade reading assessment. He tested at the line for needing special services. As I complained to my aunt about his lack of ambition, she told me she thought he was dyslexic. My response was, no, he's just lazy. She pushed me to get him tested, and after a few days of testing, we had an answer. My lazy, untrying ADD kindergartner wasn't lazy, wasn't ADD, and was trying harder than I had ever known. Isaiah's dyslexic. As I began to research, I learned that all of Isaiah's issues were related to his dyslexia. The signs were there, but I just didn't know what they were pointing to. Isaiah would get physically tired while reading. He was easily distracted. He would guess at what the next word was rather than read it. He was reading pictures. His letters were backwards, upside down, and sometimes just in the wrong spot. He would read letters that weren't there, put the letters in the wrong order, and sometimes we just had no idea where he was pulling those letters or sounds from. He reads word for word and remembers almost none. His short-term memory is pretty much non-existent. My son understands 7 to 9% of what he reads. He only understands about 39% of what's read to him. And these are all red flags for dyslexia, and if I had known that, I would have been able to help him a lot earlier. Isaiah is now in first grade and struggles is an understatement. He goes to a great school, but doesn't get the services he needs. They don't teach him to read as a dyslexic. They don't teach him the tools he needs to be successful. And it isn't for a lack of desire or resources. Our school has 2 trained teachers, and he still can't get services because the school's hands are tied by state regulations. Isaiah scores very high in math, and because of that, he scores 2 points above the cutoff for special education classes. He sees a reading interventionist who teaches him to read in an effective manner. Isaiah has learned to listen to what she says, memorize it, and repeat it back to her. And this frustrates me as a parent. It makes me mad that our school has the tools to help him, and they can't use them. Isaiah's teachers are as frustrated as we are. They see him crying in the classroom. They see him falling behind, and we all know the answer, and we just can't use it. Isaiah does not belong in special education, but he does need to be taught to read in a different manner. There's no reason my son shouldn't be able to read at or above grade level. Thinking long term, helping Isaiah now will decrease the cost to intervene later. My third grade students aren't learning to read, or are no longer learning to read, they're reading to learn. If we don't help these kids learn to read early on, the costs add up, and we are not just teaching them to read, but we have to reteach them all the stuff they should have learned before. Isaiah has a right to a public education that gives him the tools to succeed, the most basic of which is the ability to read. Because Isaiah is not getting this at school, Isaiah receives tutoring after school from a trained teacher. She does this on her own time she should be spending with her kids, an hour a night, 3 days a week. Isaiah cannot do other after-school enrichment classes because his school day ends an hour after everybody else's. And because of logistics, tutoring requires that his four siblings sit in the car for an hour and wait for him to get done with school. Isaiah's tutor barely knew him before she offered to help. She had heard of our frustrations with the system and felt she had to help Isaiah because she says it's the right thing to do. She does this because she was once a lazy, uninterested, uncaring, untrying ADD student, and so is her son.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, I want to call your attention to our visitors. This is Special Education Day on the Hill, and we welcome all of you who are teachers or a part of our special education program. So thank you for coming to visit us today. And again, thank you for your work and your concern for our children. We have Ms. Berger, we have another testifier.
We do. I'd like to introduce Jane Conlin.
Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Jane Conlin, and I am a teacher with over 30 years of experience. I've taught in private schools. I've taught in the public schools. I've spent many, many years teaching special ed, and I also am working in the charter schools. And the problem that I've observed in my experience is that teachers really don't have the background and have the knowledge that they need to identify and find these kids who have dyslexia in their classes. They are feeling stuck, and they want to help these kids they've tried interventions, they've tried all the different things, and these kids are not making the progress they should. So our teachers want to help, but they really don't necessarily know how. The other piece that I have observed is that if a teacher does have an idea that it might be dyslexia, they're reluctant to bring that word up to the parents, to say to the parent, you know, I know we've been trying hard, I know you've been trying hard, we're not making the progress, I wonder if. It's almost like it's a naughty word. Teachers who find out that I am well-versed in dyslexia and I'm certified to teach using proper methods for it will come and whisper to me, will you come look at this child because I think it might be dyslexia? And they whisper the word. It's always amazing to me. They've asked administrations to have me come in and talk to their staff meetings about dyslexia, and they are told, well, it might be confusing. I think let's just not do this right now. So I see that as an issue. And the solution is going to be if we can get the definition of dyslexia into our statutes, it's going to open that door for teachers to be able to use that word without whispering the word to us. It's going to give us an open line for communication and to be able to say to parents, you know what, it might be dyslexia. This is what I've seen before. We should look at it. The other piece I see about that is I work a lot with parents. I coach parents. They've got my name. They call me. They're frustrated. My child isn't progressing. I heard that you might be able to give us some direction and teach us what to do. These parents are kids of third, fourth, fifth, junior high school kids. These kids have missed years and years and years of help. I have helped a number of middle school children who came in frustrated, hating school, behavioral problems, all kinds of things happen. Well, if you don't understand what's going on in school, you're going to try and figure out how to get out of it. And I've seen a turnaround in these kids when we're able to teach them in the method that they need in order to learn to read and spell. These kids who weren't even thinking of college are now taking the ACTs and looking bigger and broader for themselves because they know they can do it. They finally feel some success. So I guess I just see that we need to get the information out there. We need to have a conversation. We need to be able to find ways for teachers to learn more so that when that child isn't making it, dyslexia is one of the things they consider and we talk about and we give these kids some help. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Conlon. And then we have two of our most esteemed women from here in the Twin Cities who have worked for years in raising the standards in our reading program. So would you two come forward, please, and just lend a brief moment of support to this bill? Please say your name for the record and begin.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting us forward. My name is Susan Thompson, and I'm a parent. I'm an active community member, and I love our public schools. I came forward in 06 through 2010 and lived over here for a long time working. I had the privilege to work with many of you on different bills that related to our reading achievement gap in the state. And two of them we're looking at today, the local literacy plan. I love that we have this law and that it really supports a strong partnership between our parents and our schools. And I wanted to be here today. There are other people doing the very heavy lifting on this bill. I'm here in strong support to say that the original intention of the bill, which we spent a lot of time on, is honored by the amendments that they're putting forward. We all know when you write bills, you do the best you can, and then reality happens and you observe it in action. So this bill has been a good bill, but it can be better, and these amendments make it better. So I really encourage support of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. And to our other longtime supporter, welcome. Please say your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Erickson. My name is Bette Erickson, and I'm a parent and member, parent from the Minneapolis Public School District, and I have a daughter with dyslexia that brought my me to this point. And I also was a certified teacher when she was unable to read, and I didn't have the skills to teach her to read, and we didn't have the term dyslexia, and so I didn't have access to the resources that are available. So what I'd like to say is there is power in the word dyslexia. It's been a term that's been used for 4 or 5 decades by every neurologist, psychologist, researcher, the media. You know, Jennifer Aniston has dyslexia. And the school setting and atmosphere is the only place that I can think of where we don't freely talk about and discuss dyslexia. And yet reading is the challenge of our students with dyslexia. And reading, I think we can all agree, is the goal, one of the primary goals of sending our students to school. So I just, again, wanted to be here in support of the terrific work that the dyslexia, Decoding Dyslexia group has done. And thank you to the members of this committee for your continued work on education in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Is there anyone in the audience with concerns? With that, we have a question from Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, actually, I just wanted to thank Representative Runbeck. They've been working really long on this, and although the testifiers are all speaking to a particular type of reading difficulty, we worked together to make sure that this applies broadly and specifically on line 1.16 and 1.17 to determine the proper intervention for a specific student is a part I think is particularly important in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Urusso.
Thank you for your help, too.
Yes, and thank you, Representative Runbeck, for thanking Representative Urusso. She was a part of the working group that's done good work. With that, I'm going to renew your motion. I don't think we have to do a summary. I think we've heard this. So I will renew my motion that House File 332 be recommended, be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Christensen. And if you have testifiers, would they please join you at the table? So anyone testifying for 804, please join us. And Representative Christensen, if you would move your bill to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Madam Chair, I move we lay over House File 804 for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Thank you. Will you please explain your bill?
Madam Chair, members, House File 804 repeals the due process program, online reporting program for the for special educators that's currently being developed by the Department of Education. I've received a lot of feedback from constituents, from special educators, from special ed administrators, and parents of students in special education that this program will not reduce paperwork. It will make their jobs harder and force them to spend more time focused on paperwork and less time on students. I think some of my testifiers can probably add some firsthand knowledge to this.
Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin. Mr. Lundell, were you going to introduce them, perhaps?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was going to introduce
Please introduce yourself, please.
Brad Lundell, Schools for Minnesota Administrator of Special Education. I'm introducing today Dr. Kim Gibbons, who's no stranger to this body, who's testified here before. She's from the St. Croix River Education District, and Diane McCarron from the Southwest West Central Service Cooperative.
Welcome to our committee. I think, Ms. Gibbons, you're going to begin. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As Brad said, my name is Dr. Kim Gibbons. I'm currently the Executive Director of the St. Croix River Education District, and I'm also past president of the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 804, which Representative Christensen said would repeal 125A.85, which directs the Commissioner of Education to customize a statewide online reporting system for special education. This bill would also require school districts to use an online system that would have statewide portability. MACE applauds efforts to promote statewide portability. We believe that this requirement will promote seamless transitions for students who move from district to district. And in fact, you might be interested to know that about 85% of school districts in Minnesota are currently using a system that allows for statewide portability. And we really see the value in that. We're opposed to a single system for a number of reasons. The idea of a statewide system was originally proposed as a way to reduce paperwork for special education teachers. And, you know, as a director of an education district with 180 special education staff members, I'm really struggling to see the connection with how a statewide system is going to reduce paperwork when, in fact, most of the state is already using an online IEP program. So it's really hard to see the connection with how that will reduce paperwork for teachers. In fact, I think it could probably be argued that if a statewide system is put into place and it's owned and housed at the Minnesota Department of Education, MDE will then be responsible for monitoring all of the data within the system. And I believe that this will place an imbalanced emphasis on compliance and could probably end up increasing paperwork for teachers due to all of the corrections that would ensue from monitoring findings. Finally, MACE is concerned about the high training costs that will be incurred by a statewide system. The St. Croix River Education District converted to a new system about 8 years ago. And at that point in time, we had to train all of our teachers. It took two full days of training and then ample follow-up throughout the school year. I currently have around 180 staff that would need training, and if we just looked at the cost of 2 days of training, it's $100,800 just for the 2 days, and not including the follow-up that would happen during the year. So thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ms. McCarron, welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I am Diane McCarron. I am a parent of a child who had a disability and was on an IEP. I am a 25-plus year special education teacher and used special education online forms. And currently, I'm a special education director for the Southwest West Central Service Co-op. I'd like to talk about a recent experience. Last week, I had to replace my computer. Well, my new computer does the same things as my old computer did. I still read and answer emails. I still create documents and PowerPoints. I still review online forms, special ed due process paperwork forms. It hasn't reduced my paperwork. In fact, since getting that new computer, I have spent hour after frustrating hour learning how to use the new system and completing tasks that used to take me seconds. It's now taking me hours because I have a new system to learn. I feel like mandating a single new statewide IEP system is a lot like my getting that new computer. It's going to do the same thing. The new system that we are required to have does not reduce any paperwork. All the same forms are still being required by MDE. We have in Minnesota over 15,000 plus special education teachers, speech clinicians, school psychologists, and administrators who, if we use Kim's marker, would take 2 days to learn how to use the new system. This is not counting our occupational therapists, our physical therapists, our audiologists, and all the administrative assistants. So if you take those 15,000 plus people 2 days, we now are having 30,000 days that we're not serving kids because we're learning how to use my new and frustrating computer. Over 80% of the school districts in the state currently use a system that was designed in Minnesota and continues to meet the needs of special education teachers because of the local involvement and local development. The system we currently use also provides documentation that we use for our MA billing, and it does both Part B and Part C, or birth to 21 forms. If we have a new system right now that, as legislation is written, it only provides part of those forms. And so now teachers are going to have to use two different systems to complete all their work. Again, adding more paperwork time, working on paperwork, and less time with students. Funding has been set aside to do this, but not for all the forms that we need. The kids that need our time the most will have less time because of the new state online reporting system. So I urge you to support House File 804. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, both of you. Is there anyone in the audience with concerns? Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Darren Cordy. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Education. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify here today on House File 804 and for the opportunity to provide some information about the new online system and hopefully clear up some misunderstandings that I think are out there in the field about this system. I do appreciate the concerns that have been brought forth here today by the proponents of this bill, but we feel that the proposal to repeal the online system is premature. As you may know, this legislation directing MDE to establish a system was passed just 8 months ago. After it passed, we gathered a diverse group of stakeholders to provide input on what they wanted to see in the online system, provided a list of that work group participants to you, but you can see that it included special education directors, teachers, advocates, and MDE experts that participated in the work group. Together, they helped craft the request for proposal, which was released late last year. The RFP application window closed in late January, and the proposals were reviewed extensively by the review team, and just this week, a vendor was selected. In fact, the contract for the system hasn't even been signed yet. The vendor is an educational technology company called Incent, and the product, their system is called Enrich. It's already used as a state system in two states, South Carolina and Colorado. Both of these states reported reductions, albeit modest ones, in the amounts of paperwork that teachers were completing using the system. What they found was that some districts have locally required or vendor-provided paperwork that are above and beyond what is required by state and federal law. The system will include only the state and federal requirements and nothing more. There will also be some reductions through the automation of certain paperwork, such as progress charting, mileage and expense reporting, and time tracking. We've never argued that the system will be a silver bullet for paper reduction, but we do think that it will make a modest impact. Perhaps the biggest impact that we hope this system will provide is a reduction in the amount of time that teachers spend on paperwork. Through the pre-population and automation features of the system, we expect there to be significant efficiency gains in the amount of time that teachers spend on paperwork. Regarding the monitoring concerns, there's nothing in 125A.085 that increases the rights or responsibilities of MDE to review student IEP data. And the current monitoring cycle would not change. IEP data would not be housed at MDE. It would be housed on a third-party server owned by the vendor. And since MDE would not have possession or ownership of that data, we've checked with the U.S. Department of Education, and they've confirmed that MDE would not be responsible for reviewing every IEP that's on the system. IEPs would continue to be reviewed as they currently are. The system would cover documentation for both IDEA Part C and Part B students. There wouldn't be a separate system for Part C, so it would be a birth to 21 system. And the system would also cover needed documentation for medical assistance third-party billing. Again, there wouldn't need to be a separate system for that. Along with time savings for teachers, a huge benefit would be the ability to seamlessly transfer data between LEAs, which is kind of the combined term we use for districts, charters, cooperatives, and education districts, and then also between LEAs and MDE. This would ensure that files are transferred quickly and accurately, reducing teacher burdens to track down files and manually enter data. So it also eliminate gaps in services for students when they transfer schools that are using different systems. We appreciate the local control concerns that are made by the bill proponents. Currently, the statute requires the system to be made available to LEAs beginning in the 15-16 school year free of charge, and LEAs are not required to use the online system until the 2018-2019 school year. Our hope is, as we pilot the system and use feedback to continually improve it, LEAs will voluntarily choose to migrate to the system, and we won't need to have a mandate in place. But either way, the system hasn't even gotten up and running yet, and I would encourage you to allow us to bring the system to market, allow leading districts to pilot the system, allow us to use feedback to continually improve the system, and as 2018 approaches, if there continue to be concerns about the system, if nobody likes it, if nobody's using it, then I think we could talk about repealing it at that time. But until then, we've put a lot of work into this, getting to this point, and we really would like to see it through, so I would hope that the committee would consider postponing this bill until a later date. That being said, we also did meet with MACE yesterday with their executive director and had a really productive conversation. So I'm hoping that there may be some compromised language that we can come up with that both parties can agree to in this situation. But with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to stand for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. And we do have a question for Representative Kreisha.
And thank you, Mr. Cordy. I know how much time and effort you've put into this, and thank you. Just for the record, has the RFP been awarded?
Yes.
Mr. Cordy.
And I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, yes, it has.
And you didn't share who the company was, where they were from, and what the cost was. Do you have that available?
Madam Chair, Cordy. Representative Kreisha, the company's name is Enrich. I believe they're based out of Georgia, but I can get back to you on that. I don't have that information with me. And we don't have the total cost yet because the contract is now that we've selected them as the vendor, we start the contract negotiation process.
Yes, the Representative Kreisha.
And thank you. So Enrich out of Georgia, and they have a better grasp of the Minnesota special ed laws than our current vendors? And you don't have to answer that. That seems a little bit surprising to me, so thank you.
And Mr. Cordy, you mentioned that the third-party vendor will own the data. Would MDE's third-party vendor own the student data it houses, or what is this? Please explain when you say own the data.
Madam Chair, I think maybe the term own isn't the correct one. What we have been told by the U.S. Department of Education is, say, if and what we've said to districts is when we receive an IEP, we're required to go through it and make sure that it is done in compliance with IDEA and with state law. There was some concern by the districts and by our staff, frankly, that if this data was to be housed at MDE and we were to have possession of it, would we be required to review every single IEP for 100% compliance then? So we did check with USDOE, and they said, as long as you don't have possession of the data that's being housed with a third-party vendor, then we're not required to do that extent of monitoring.
Representative Kreisha, I think he has a follow-up for you.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Cordy. So I'm glad you brought that up. So, and you can get this to me later, but is the data going to be stored at MDE? Is it going to be stored in the cloud around the country, or is it going to be stored at the headquarters of the Georgia company? And what happens, I mean, what happens if there's disconnects on that data? I'm just, one of the things I'm concerned about is, unfortunately, living in this world, I know what happens when outages happen. And it sounds to me like one thing that we should think through is, if that data is at MDE, does that mean Georgia is remotely accessing that and working on that data, or are they going to put people here if those servers go down? I shouldn't say if, when they go down. Mm-hmm. Or if that cloud, and I'm sure you guys are thinking through all this, but if that cloud goes down, like at a Rackspace or a major server, does the whole state have an outage until it comes back up? So I just, if you could get that back to me, those are questions that I would love to know, because that'll have a huge local impact.
Thank you, Representative Crucia. Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, Representative Crucia, yes, I'll certainly touch base with our IT folks and get back to you on this. It's actually our Minute Services that are negotiating this contract, so they're definitely having those conversations. I also think it would be helpful maybe at some point, if the committee would like it, and Madam Chair, if you would like it, to actually have the vendor come in and maybe do a demonstration of the product and answer some of those technical questions.
Representative Crucia, thank you, Mr. Cordy.
And thank you. And so one of the, we had an earlier bill earlier. Sorry, I was redundant. We had a bill earlier that dealt with student data for paraprofessionals and IEPs. And one of the things that I'm concerned about is if we can't get that access to those aides or those paras because the servers are down, it's just a concern. And I know we're working through all this, but just want to be thoughtful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. And we have others with concerns. And very quickly, please. Representative Urso, do you have a question for Mr. Cordy?
Well, for some of the testifiers we've had so far.
Don't go far, testifiers, because I'm laying this bill over in about 5 minutes. So very quickly,
good morning.
Education
yes.
Minnesota.
Yep. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm only introducing. We have three experts here and people who are very passionate. They are all three special educators, and I'm also happy to start with the person who understands this as well as anyone, as she authored the very bill that House File 804 would repeal. So we'll start with Mary Swatsky.
Representative Swatsky, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and legislators and committee members. And thank you, Representative Christensen, and greetings from your relatives in Wilmer, Minnesota. They send hello and wish you well. So, I am from Wilmer. I am a Wilmer Public School teacher of 30 years. Just began my 30th year in January. And the bill that I brought forward was an offshoot of the Office of the Legislative Auditor Committee evaluation report, offering key facts and findings along with key recommendations. And in absence, or because of the time that we have, I'm going to skip over, because you probably all have that blue folder or binder of that report somewhere in your files. But as it turns out, because of that report, a committee was convened with several players and agencies and stakeholders, lawyers, parents, directors, MACE, co-ops, administrators, teachers, advocacy groups, legislators like myself, and the department, who worked 6 months with very little movement about or consensus on how to evaluate and the workload versus the caseload dilemma, as well as how we were, the progress of the $1.7 million that was allotted to the department to do something with paperwork reduction and redundancy. And so, frustrated with that committee, I came up with my bill. And with that, and with the help of a survey in a matter of 4 days over the holidays in 2013, from a Friday to Christmas Eve on Tuesday, over 700 responses were recorded, with 73% of the teachers who work with this information supported a statewide online system. Now, with that, I'm going to tell you with a real-life story, and it's not so old, because when one door closes, another opens. And on January 5th, I went back to the classroom of this year as a full-time special education teacher. This year, my district switched vendors from for the due process. And due process is the unfunded mandate of paperwork in special education. And as I was working on a new IEP, individual education plan, I realized that vendor A which we had used last year. On the short ender, this is a very conservative IEP. It was only a 5-page report. When we switched to vendor B this year, that same student, needs had not changed drastically, was 14 pages. Madam Chair, Minnesota has 7 vendors for due process. All include the federal requirements. Each contain Minnesota state mandates, and every vendor includes local district wants. So, in keeping with skipping over some of my testimony, I have been receiving inquiries from different agencies, directors, lobbyists, co-ops, teachers, wondering how one statewide online system would alleviate paperwork. I've been transparent along this journey all the way. This law that was passed last year was only the beginning. Last year, I had bipartisan support to reduce state mandates. I wish my colleagues who were so on board with me last year and who had their own stories to share from right in their own homes would have taken the next step to reduce some of those state mandates. MDE is now in the direction, needed direction for their $1.7 million that was allotted. And as a taxpayer, that money, as a concerned taxpayer, that money did not need to go into recreating the wheel. Thus, the department had asked for an RFP. The Minnesota Public Schools will have access to a free due process system. Student teachers can tackle this online system in college, be prepared when they get out into the real world. Parents will become familiar with the document, no matter how mobile they are. Translations into various languages will be unified and available for all. Teachers will have access immediately from district to district with confidentiality. And I would like to make note that Representative Holberg and Representative Scott were adamant with this information was being tracked, recorded, and handled by only those in direct consent in need of the information per private data regulations and FERPA, which is Family Education Rights and Privacy. So today, MDE monitors files that are located in our buildings, not in our present computer systems. And with that said, I would challenge those who disagree with how MDE monitors, how that would create more paperwork for the teacher. And in I would like to insert here an answer to Representative Kreisha's questions. Not, we don't live by the computer program, the IEP, day to day to day to day. We know that. When I'm working on the IEP, it's from probably 4 to 8 at night on weekends. So if the system is down, which is quite regularly statewide or business-wide or industry-wide, so we're not, if we're sticking and sitting on the computer when we're supposed to be with our students, that's probably a no-no right there. So if the system is down, but we have a paper copy of the IEP if we need to go to refer to that document.
Thank you, Representative Swatsky. I have to cut you off there
Thank
because
you.
We have rules ready to come in. Members, I'm going to lay this bill over. This meeting is adjourned.